Say, kids, what time is it? Time for another episode of Brio TV, the podcast. I'm your host, Bill Brio. This episode is brought to you by CTV, Hollywood Suite, Paramount Plus, and Super Channel. Express yourself. So, do I have a special guest for you today? This is a conversation with one of my TV heroes, Dave Thomas. His career took off, with Second City and SCTV, where he shone with the likes of comedy peers John Candy, Joe Flaherty, Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Rick Moranis, Catherine O'Hara, and Martin Short. He was also part of that famous Toronto production of Godspell, made the Bob and Doug movie, Strange Brew with Moranis, and starred in the Dave Thomas Show on CBS. He went on to spend 5 seasons on Grace Under Fire. He then did a career 180, becoming a writer-producer on such network TV dramas as Bones and The Blacklist. He's even co-written a sci-fi novel. Plus, he's got some great stories about comedy legends Bob Hope and Johnny Carson. I've been interviewing him over the years for TV Guide and the Toronto Sun and other places, and it was just really great to catch up with him just days ago over Zoom. Here he is. The pride of St. Catharines, Ontario, Dave Thomas. Well, my guest today is Dave Thomas. My God, we've talked over the years. No one's a bigger fan of this man than I am. And so great thrill to have you here and talk about your amazing career. Dave, thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill. It's great.
I'm looking at your into your private den there. Lots of books on the shelves. Lots of cool stuff. That's quite a collection. Good for you.
I'm a pack rat. My wife would really like all of that gone.
Yeah, I am. I have a similar partner who is working on that every day. But let's get started. There's so many great stories, of course, SCTV and, I don't know, we'll get to everything. But I wanted to go back to the beginning, to your early roots. And you're from St. Catharines originally, correct?
I was born there, but I think we moved. My parents moved when I was 1 or 2. And then we went to Toronto. And I was there till I was 6. And then we went to Durham, North Carolina.
Yeah.
Wow. And I was there till I was 12. And then we went to the UK for a year and a half, something like that. And then came back to Canada. And I went to high school in Canada.
Durham is a beautiful place, isn't it? I've been down to the university there.
That's where my dad was. He was at Duke in the philosophy department. And yeah, but we were there in the late 50s. And it was a completely different place then. There was this sort of Ivy League school surrounded by cigarette factories.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was like, it was tobacco country far more than it was academia. So
I went to the University of Toronto and they had an exchange called the Tar Heel Exchange.
Oh,
with
the Tar Heels.
Chapel Hill, right? North Carolina University. And one of the perks of that was we got to tour the Liggett Myers cigarette factory.
Sure.
And every one of us, there's 38 of us from U of T, and as you're leaving as a souvenir, they give you a cigarette that's about 5 meters long didn't get cut up properly.
Okay, Bill, I was there with my class in the 3rd grade for a tour. And at the end of the tour, they gave every kid a carton of cigarettes. I'm not kidding. It was just like, okay, well, I guess these guys aren't worried about being politically correct or addicting children on their hideous devices.
You probably could have traded that for a bunch of chocolate bars, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. Well, you make your way back to Canada. And from what I understand, when you were starting out working, you worked first at an ad agency in Toronto. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Now,
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I talked to Chuck Tatham, the writer who you worked with, I think, on Arrested Development a bit. But he also started out in advertising, and I'm just wondering, what's the link between advertising and comedy?
Well, I don't know if it's a link between advertising and comedy specifically, although one of the first things I did on SCTV was commercial parodies.
Right.
Because that was easy for me. And the other thing you learn in advertising is you can say a lot in 30 seconds. And one of the real problems with early sketch writers, I mean, early in their careers, everything they do is too long. Everything they write is way too long.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you need the shortest road to the joke, and you need to get out of there. And so I think I learned the value of the seconds in advertising, that, you know, 30 seconds is you can say this much, in 60 you can say this much, and then if you can't say it in 60, well, then you're not really a communicator.
Right. Yeah.
And you know,
you also have to have a beginning, middle, and end.
Well, actually, that was true in sketch writing until the Pythons came along.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, they would, in the middle of a sketch, have someone go, all right, that's enough. We've had enough of this. No more. Moving on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that, to me, was wonderful. That was like a pivotal change in my conceptual view of comedy writing, because it was like, oh, I see. If you can just do something where you can just do the joke and then find a way to get out and move on to the next thing, that's the most economical kind of sketch writing that you can do. Because I sat in a lot of writing rooms with different showrunners and Lorne Michaels and people like that, and they all said a sketch has to have a beginning, middle, and end. So in the writing room, a writer would come up with a funny idea, and then the showrunner would say, well, go write it up. And what he meant was, take that one funny idea and build this cathedral of structure around it, a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And invariably, people, you know, you'd say to somebody, so what do you think of that sketch? Well, there was one funny thing in it, but I thought it went on too long, and I hated the ending. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So there is a problem with that beginning, middle, and end structure if you're too rigid with it. If you enforce it in a way that isn't natural to the comedy or good for the joke.
Yeah, and you're right. Python did that, and now for something completely different that just switched you into the next thing, didn't it?
So when we did SCTV, we discovered that there was this format of the little television show presenting its programming day, and that we didn't have to do a whole scene. We could do a promo for an upcoming show, and that would be cuts. So right. We could just do the jokes. Then we could do commercial parodies, and they would be like 30 seconds or 60 seconds. And then when somebody had a brilliant idea and wrote something that kind of spun out a little longer, you could have things that breathed a little bit, but you were able to pace the show with this faster stuff that broke the rules of beginning, middle, and end.
Isn't it funny, Dave, how today it's almost like the whole world works that way, that you only want to see the promo. Like, even if it's a sports event, like a hockey game, I don't want to sit and watch three periods. Get me to the sports clips or the highlights, right? And it's almost the same way with any show now.
Well, yeah, there is a shrinking attention span in Canada and America. And I think that the internet has done a lot to do that, because, you know, you can go on YouTube and just see a clip, you know. Why do you want to watch a show if you can just see a clip, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. But I still like story, though. It's funny, I got into story late in my career. I mean, I was writing movies at the very beginning, and then I abandoned them for sketches. And then I came back to them later while experimenting with other stuff. I mean, I literally have done every kind of TV except news.
Right.
I've done reality. I've done animation. I've done TV movies. I've done half-hour sitcoms. I've done half-hour single cams. I've done one-hour dramas and one-hour procedurals.
Game shows.
Yeah, I created a game show when I was doing Grace Under Fire, because I got kind of bored just acting in that show. And it was called Family Challenge. And I sold to ABC as a pilot, and then they didn't want to do it as a series. So I took it out and I sold it to Family Channel. And while I was doing Grace Under Fire, we shot 144 episodes of this show called Family Challenge. It was a stupid show, and I wasn't even on the set. But game shows are stupid, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel bad that it was stupid.
Well, wow. Amazing. Yeah. So you were working in an ad agency, and then how did you make the transition from there to, I don't know, would it have been Godspell or whatever was the next step for you in terms of comedy? Second City, obviously, I guess, right?
Chronologically, Godspell was first. Then after Godspell, I couldn't get any work. So then I went to the phone, Yellow Pages. I wrote up a bunch of fake ads, went through alphabetically. And by the time I got to the M's at McCann Erickson, I got hired. And I got hired on trial, low salary. And they put me as a junior writer on the Coca-Cola account, which is basically just writing their retail stuff, which is just awful. It's like the print ads for newspapers and things like that. It's, if you're a writer, you're looking at that and you're going, what the hell happened to my life? So then there was a commercial for a contest that got dumped on me because no one else wanted to do it. And they gave it to me. There were 30 seconds of legal copy that I had to do in a 30-second spot. And I thought, well, there's no room for creativity here. And then I remembered this thing that I'd seen Don Knotts do on the old Tonight Show, where he played this weatherman where he had too much information. He had these pull-down charts that, and then another one, and then snap back up, and he had a pointer, and it was a breakaway, and things like that. So he had kind of physical gags, and he made a bit out of how much information that he had to tell. So I wrote the spot like that. And then I took it to the creative director, and he said, well, this is great, but you're never going to be able to sell this as a script to Coca-Cola. You have to go up there and perform it for them. And I said, okay. So I went up and I performed it for them, and they loved it. And they said, who do you want to be in this? And I said, Tim Conway, just as a, you know, pie in the sky wish. Less than 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to LA to shoot that spot with Tim Conway.
Wow.
And then that became that commercial was a huge success. It was called Capital Caps. And Coca-Cola said to the creative director, we want you to make this kid who came up with that commercial the head writer for Coca-Cola Canada.
Wow.
So now I'm only 3 months into advertising, and suddenly I'm the head writer for Coca-Cola Canada.
That's great.
So I did a couple of lifestyle spots. And then this guy who was the head of McCann in New York named Bill Backer, he wrote It's the Real Thing, Coke, and Things Go Better with Coke. And he did that Mountaintop commercial with I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing.
So he was the real Mad Men guy.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
Wow.
So they send me down to meet with Bill Backer. And, you know, I've just done a master's degree and coursework in Shakespeare and Chaucer and Milton. And I go into this guy's office on Lexington Avenue in New York, strange little man with a bow tie and a gray suit. And I sit down in his sumptuous office, and he starts quoting Shakespeare. And I'm thinking, well, what the hell is this? What? So I knew reams of Shakespeare because I just graduated 2 years before, you know? Yeah. So I started quoting Shakespeare back. Well, that was my ticket to ride. It was so weird. He loved me after that, and he got me to write a spot for him. And then I got a big raise. I got sent to England to shoot this spot. And now I was working at McCann in New York. And then Eugene Levy calls me, and he says, they got openings in the cast in Toronto for Second City. We're going away some of us are going to Pasadena to start a new show. And he said, but you got to get up here, right? So I flew from New York to get to Toronto, and I auditioned. And it was a 5-day, 4-day-long audition, Monday through Thursday, joining the improv set at Second City at the old fire hall. And I got in. So then I quit my advertising job. And I remember going in to see the guy who was the president of McCann. The company was called Interpublic that owned McCann Erickson.
Yeah.
Because this creative director, Bill Backer, said, I want him down here. He's gone away. Where is he? And he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I got a job offer. And he said, well, how much are they paying you? I said, $145 a week. And he laughed and he said, you're kidding. And I said, no. He said, well, what is it? And I told him, and he said, and you really want to do this? And I said, yeah. He said, look, Bill Backer really wants you. He said, we'll hold this job for you for a year.
Wow.
And if you go get this out of your system and come back in a year, we'll give you your job back and a nice raise. So I went to Second City, but I never looked back. You know what I mean? It was
amazing.
Like,
what a story.
Once I got on that stage, it was just, you know.
So you had no hesitation taking a big pay cut.
Hell no, because I was doing what I loved. And I was like, I don't know, 24, 23, something like that.
See, this started off as the greatest endorsement of studying Shakespeare I've ever heard. And then you just threw it away. But God bless you for doing that. What a smart man. I mean, that would have been scary for a lot of people to have turned your back on this other career, right?
Well, it was scary in a way because I didn't know if I'd get fired or I didn't know if that show would close because there had been a Second City before the one at the fire hall on Adelaide Street that had closed. Huh. And it had only been open for 2 months or something like that. So, and I had gone to see that show, and that show had Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner and Valerie Bromfield and Joe Flaherty and Brian Doyle Murray, Bill Murray's brother. It was a great show and a great cast. So I was already a fan of this Second City when Eugene called me. And I mean, Eugene in a way is kind of my mentor because he got me into Godspell too. So it was like, you know, Eugene and Marty are my buddies from McMaster.
Yeah.
We went to school together and we've stayed friends to this day and still very close. And
yeah.
Talk to each other pretty regularly. But Eugene called me and that was my ticket. So then I was in this company at Second City Stage and I was working with, well, John Candy came back, but first with Dan Aykroyd. And I was with Dan for about, I don't know, 3, 4 months, 5 months, something like that. And then Dan went to SNL. But John came back from Pasadena because that company closed. So then I'm on stage with John Candy and just having the greatest time. Catherine O'Hara's in the cast. Andrea Martin's in the cast. It was great. And it was so much fun. And then I was only in Second City Stage for 2 years and I was getting kind of restless. And then Bernie Solins and Andrew Alexander decided to start SCTV.
Yeah.
And I had the least performing experience of anyone in the show, but the most writing experience except for Harold Ramis. And so, there's someone at my door. Can you believe that?
Do you need to take that, Dave?
I don't know. Okay. Hold on one sec.
Yeah,
I can come right back to this.
Okay. Don't take off, eh? We'll be right back in a minute with Dave Thomas. Well, we're here again with Emily Gagné from Hollywood Suite. Emily, what do you got for us this month?
Well, Bill, we've got the last couple of episodes of The Last Movie Stars, which I know I talked to you about before. It's a 6-part docuseries about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, directed by Ethan Hawke, and it's really spectacular. You can watch it Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Through February 16th, so right around Valentine's Day, perfect time to watch it. We're also going to have a marathon if you want to just watch it all in one sitting on February 18th.
It's a great series. I'm glued to it. So many big names attached to this makes it a lot of fun. So congrats on that. What else is coming up?
Also, we have a collection of movies by Black creators. We're calling it Black Excellence. It's for Black History Month. We got a little bit of everything from nostalgic classics like Do the Right Thing and House Party to modern masterpieces like Moonlight and Pariah. So definitely check it out if you have time this month.
All great movies. Listen, Emily, thank you so much. Remember, all month long on Hollywood Suite, check them out. Well, we're deep into mid-season, folks, and CTV sure has their share of what's new and of interest this winter. Have you been watching Night Court? Now, I wasn't sure about this reboot, but it's a wonderful surprise. It's great to see original cast member John Larroquette hasn't lost his edge or comedy chops. And seeing him back on that old courtroom set, well, something very comforting about that. Plus, you know, the show's pretty damn funny. Speaking of familiar faces, Milo Ventimiglia from This Is Us is back in the new drama, The Company You Keep. This time, he's all spiffed up in a tux, playing a con man who unexpectedly falls for a CIA agent. Not Dead Yet is a series I'm intrigued by. Gina Rodriguez from Jane the Virgin stars as a woman returning to a newsroom only to be handed a dead-end job, writing obits. Damned if she doesn't start seeing dead people. Just three of the new shows to get into this winter on CTV.
I remember setting out just to see what I could see.
And we're back with Dave. Listen, Dave, let me just back up for a second. You're talking about all these people in Toronto. And I know, I mean, you've written an entire book about this, about growing up and doing all, living on Avenue Road, I think, and all of these Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner and everybody. So you have thought of this. What is your reflection on all of this comedy talent being on the same few streets in Toronto and Hamilton at the same time? You know, I mean, it just seems like a very unique time, right?
Marty Short has romanticized this to being like Paris in the 20s for artists.
Yeah.
And that might be a bit of an overstatement, but honestly, what I felt was that it was an amazing congregation of like-minded people who had the same idea of what was funny. And it's really odd, Bill, because, you know, there's comedy and comedy. There's some comedy that I watch, like, I don't think that's funny. And then there's other comedy I watch and I go, I could only dream that I could write comedy that well. And so, you know, I thought John Candy was really funny. I thought Dan Aykroyd was really funny. I thought Gilda Radner was funny. Andrea Martin was really funny. Marty was hilarious and Eugene was funny. So these people, we all became friends and we were all looking for something to do. First was Godspell. That was the first show that allowed some of these like-minded people to assemble in one place and do one thing. And then when that closed, everybody kind of went off and did their own thing for a while. And then Second City, first on Adelaide, then on Lombard, became another kind of a focal point, a gathering point for these people, you know? So you get like Joe Flaherty and John Candy and Eugene Levy and Andrea Martin and Gilda Radner and Dan Aykroyd and Catherine O'Hara and me, lucky to be part of that group, all going to that same building doing shows. I mean, and then later on, everybody's got their own career, you know? So I don't know.
I just think it's mind blowing. I know that you came to Godspell a little bit later, I think. And Eugene Levy, not Victor Garber, was your Jesus Christ, right? In those.
He was. And he took himself way too seriously. I was teasing him about that. I kept saying to him backstage, just remember out there, you know, you're not Jesus, okay?
Well, I don't know. It's quite a story. I was listening to, I'm sure, and you've actually been on the Gilbert Gottfried Amazing Colossal podcast.
Yeah.
God bless Gilbert Gottfried, who's passed away. But what a great this! If people aren't familiar with this podcast, it's literally just a textbook on show business, isn't it? Like all these wonderful guests and
right, featuring comedy specifically.
Yeah,
but broader base than just comedy.
Right. Yeah, and I was listening to they rebroadcast the one with Andrea Martin, and it's a delightful episode. And Paul Schaefer, who was also in that Godspell production, he cuts in, he phones in and basically was suggesting that really that she taught a lot of you how to be funny, like that there was something about her that just transcended the room and was different, right?
She was naturally funny. She was, I never saw anybody with more energy than Andrea. Andrea was, she would, you know, the phrase, someone walks into a room and lights up the room. She would light up the room with the energy of a star. Yeah. I mean, do you know what I mean? And I don't mean a movie star. I mean a solar system star. She was, the first time I met her, I was at that house that I never lived there, but I was there a lot, 1063 Avenue Road, where Eugene and Marty were renting it. And she came in and I was just dazzled by her, just dazzled. So yeah, she was pretty remarkable, and it was wonderful working with her. And strangely, you should say, Paul Schaefer dropped in on that show. I just got off the phone with him an hour before the call with you.
Wow.
He's in town. We're going out for dinner on Wednesday. So, I mean, we still stay in touch. You know what I mean? We're still friends.
It's amazing. A guy from Thunder Bay, right? You know,
That's right.
It's pretty incredible.
A wonderful musician.
Yeah. Oh, no kidding. My God. Yeah. Can play anything, anywhere. We were working our way into SCTV a bit. I wanted to back up, though, just a bit about the David Steinberg show.
Sure.
That's something that you can actually see. There are so many channels now, Dave, that you can stream anything, anywhere, right? You can go on Tubi or a Fast channel. And I was watching some of those old episodes. How did you come to be part of that mix? Because I think that was just before SCTV, right?
Yeah. I don't remember how I got the job.
But the other guys are on there as well, right?
Marty was on it. Joe was on it. John Candy was on it. And me. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember how I got it, but I think Marty was the first one that Steinberg hired. And then Marty, you know, I guess Steinberg was saying, do you have any funny friends? And then Marty just opened the door and we came in.
Away you went.
But that was my first television show. That was my first experience working in television. And the guest stars on that show were really incredible. It was like, you know, I can say to people that I worked with Ethel Merman because she was on that show. Yeah. I don't know anybody that could say that.
Even Bob and Ray were on the David
Bob
Steinberg
and Ray
show. Yeah.
And Robert Vaughn and Rip Taylor, Michelle Lee. I can't even remember all the guests, but it was like real. Oh, Phyllis Diller. It was real showbiz. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, I really felt like, oh man, this is showbiz. I can tell you a story that happened backstage. They had this set that they made, and they were these Mylar columns with chaser lights. It was pretty expensive, you know. And these columns were like big dominoes, and we were playing a game of supposedly touch football while everyone was at lunch. And John Candy tackled Marty and knocked him into one of these Mylar things, and they just went down like dominoes, just bam, 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 and just lights exploding. And we were like bad kids, and we just ran out of the studio and hid in our dressing rooms. We figured we don't want to get caught for this,
right?
So they didn't confront us. But they knew we had done that. So what we found out was The next week when we came in to do the show, instead of each having our own dressing room, Joe and John were in one and Marty and I were in the other. And then we didn't admit it. And then finally, all four of us were in. And these are dressing rooms at CFTO. They're very small dressing rooms.
Right.
And so there was the four of us in. And when you went to the dressing room, you know, there'd be three guys in there. And you knocked on the door. And the joke was, who is it? And you had to do an impersonation of David Steinberg to get in. So it's me, it's little David Steinberg out in the hall. So that was our joke, right? So we're just like bad kids. So one day Joe comes to the door and knock, knock, knock. And Marty and John and I are in there. We go, who is it? And he goes, it's me, it's little, it's Joe. It's Joe, let me in. And he's banging, and we open the door, and David is standing right behind him.
Ah.
Got him.
That is classic. That is classic. Well, anyway, let's and just, you know, thinking of Bob and Ray and radio, and you mentioned, you know, were you influenced at all on the early radio days of the Royal Canadian Air farce? I mean. You know, I remember listening to that and thinking they were pretty, they would go to a different city in Canada, right? And they were pretty funny.
Yeah. And we did, yes, we did watch Royal Canadian Air Force. I can't really think of any specific influences or ties to it.
Right.
Because when you brought that up, one of the early things that Eugene and I did was a show called the National Rock Works Company, which was on radio, on CBC radio. And we had sketches like Lance Rock, the Singing Mountie, and that was a recurring sketch. And George McLean, do you remember him, that announcer for CBC?
CBC,
He played Lance Rock. And we wrote for George and wrote funny stuff for George. And we had other stuff, little commercial parodies and sketches on that show. But that was, we got our start in radio just like, you know, Bob Hope and Bing Crosby.
Right.
Because we couldn't get jobs on TV when we first started. The first guy, when I was still working on my master's degree, I wrote five sketches and I drove to Toronto. And I took them to every TV play, you know, just knocking on doors and doors getting slammed in my face. And then I go to CBC radio and I'm thinking, oh God, now the only thing I can get is radio. And I met this guy named Jack Humphreys. I don't know if you remember him or not.
But
he was a radio producer.
Yeah.
And he looked at my sketches. I wrote eight. That's what it was. I wrote eight sketches. He read my sketches and he bought five of them right there on the spot.
Wow.
And wrote me a check for like $75 each for the five sketches. And I remember being so happy when I drove home back to Hamilton, because I thought, I'm in showbiz. I sold some scripts.
Right.
This is just amazing,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so then I don't know. Then I got a job on another CBC radio show writing. And then I pitched something with Eugene Levy, and it was National Rock Works. Oh, I know what it was. My brother Ian was a producer at CBC, and Ian was the one that put Eugene and I together to do National Rock Works. So I got that job from my brother.
Wow.
And Ian was kind of between gigs as a musician and got a job as a CBC radio producer. So
that's wild. Yeah. That's funny. All right, so we go forward a few years, and then this the Second City opportunity evolves into SCTV. You know, and just looking at your list of impressions on SCTV, and I'm sure you're tired of talking about SCTV. You've talked, you know, everybody wants to know about this, that, or the other sketch. But I'm just fascinated by all these voices you did. And, you know, some of them were obviously Bob Hope, of course, which was masterful. Walter Cronkite. And but it's just of its time, people like Lee Iacocca. G. Gordon Liddy, right? But the one that really cracks me up, Dave, is that, and it's listed this way, that you did Fred Travellina bracket as Jim Nabors. Like,
okay, there's a story else, there.
Yeah, does anything else place you in time than just that line, right? I mean,
well, I couldn't do Jim Nabors. Now, that's one of those impersonations like Jimmy Stewart that every impressionist could do. I couldn't do it. If I couldn't kind of get into the head of the person that I was impersonating, I couldn't do it. And I'll give you some links to all of these or some of these impersonations that I did. But I had no connection or no link to Jim Nabors. And you get cast as a utility player in sketches when you're doing a show like that because you just got to do so many sketches. And Rick had written this Merv Griffin thing, a parody, where he was playing Merv. And I could do Merv because I could get a connection to Merv, but Rick was already doing Merv. So Rick wrote a thing where I was playing Jim Nabors, and I couldn't do Jim Nabors. And Rick came on the set, and I was ordering a plate of peas from the prop guy. And Rick says, why are you ordering a plate of peas? I said, because I can't do Jim Nabors. So just as my line comes up, I'm going to take a mouthful of peas and do it with a mouthful of peas. So Rick laughed. And he said, you can't do Jim Nabors? And I said, no, I can't. So then Rick was the one who said, well, just do it and we'll blame it on somebody else. So I did a lousy impersonation of Jim Nabors. And then Rick, as Merv, goes, ooh, Fred Travellina as Jim Nabors. You know, so... We took the handicap that I brought to the sketch and made it a joke in the show.
Well, that is hilarious. Fred Travellina was an impressionist. And the guys back then, there'd be like Rich Little, Frank Gorshin, David Fry did a great Nixon, you know.
Yes.
But I'm glad you explained that. That is hilarious.
And then some of those other people you mentioned, like Lee Iacocca. I'll tell you why I did Lee Iacocca. Because when Lee Iacocca went to the U.S. government and said that Chrysler was losing all this money and that he needed $3 billion or he was going to have to put all these people out of work. And then I remember thinking that, well, your company makes really shitty cars. That's why you're $3 billion in debt. You shouldn't get that money from the government. So I wrote this sketch. It was a parody of this rock concert show. These rock concert shows that were on were a joke because they were paid for by the record companies
right. That
would just use them to promote artists. And they would get a license fee from the networks for the show of like $300,000, $400,000 for an hour. And that was just like money for not throwing money for nothing, you know?
Yeah.
So I did Lee Iacocca's rock concert and I started with the plea that we needed $3 million to be donated to this show, or we won't be able to bring the fine acts that, you know what I mean? So it was a joke aimed at him, but that's where that came from, you know? So
very funny. We talked earlier about Andrea Martin. Do you have a favorite sketch that the two of you and Andrea did together on SCTV sketches?
Well, Tex and Edna Boyle, of course.
Right. Yes, you of know, course. And, yeah.
Which, you know, I remember I had driven across the country a few times because between SCTV things, I would write scripts in LA. And so I drove across and I found this place I was in Missouri and it was night. And I was just trying to finish the drive for the day. And I saw this big warehouse thing. It was a retail outlet. And I went in, and it was a place that was mainly mail order, but they sold everything. And there was a section of this where they sold organs. And there was a big sign up that said, free budgie with the purchase of every organ. And I just thought, what a stupid giveaway. I can't believe it. So when I told Andrea this, we were sitting there trying to write a sketch, and I told her this story about driving across the country. She starts laughing. She said, we got to do that. We got to do these two characters. And we started working on it. And that text, Edna Boyle, was born from a reality, a place somewhere in Missouri.
Truth anyway. Is stranger than fiction, right? It's now, you know, when you flash ahead to the Trump years, Dave, I mean, if SCTV had been on then, was that beyond parody? Was there just, you totally. Could have done it, right?
No, I mean, showbiz became a parody of itself.
Yeah.
You can't parody a parody.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like a mathematical thing. It's you can't do it. And Trump was beyond. If we had done Trump in the 80s when we did SCTV, people would have gone, not believable. There's never going to be a president like that. Come on. Yeah. It's just not believable. You know?
Right. Yeah.
And I have friends who are conservative. They're right wingers, you know, and I've had discussions with them, and I've said to them, you know, their argument will always be, well, he did some good things. He did some good things for the economy. And I would say to them, yeah, but you got to admit, he is an asshole.
And
they would nod and they would go, yeah. And I would say, so let's put all the other stuff aside. Let's just say that a president can do things for the economy or not do things, but he shouldn't be an asshole.
Right.
The president of the United States shouldn't be at a G7 summit pushing Andrea Merkel out of the way so that he can be in front. He just shouldn't be an asshole.
Yeah.
And they agreed with that. Even my conservative friends would go, you know, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, he is an asshole. And the president shouldn't be an asshole.
There you go. Listen, I wanted to ask about John Candy. To me, there's a guy that, you know, can make grown men cry to this day thinking about John Candy. And I was on the set. Remember the show Transparent? There was that series that was on. Gabby Hoffman was one of the actresses on it. And she had played a little girl. She was a little girl in Uncle Buck. And I asked her for a John Candy story, and oh my God, she told me when, you know, and she's like six and she's acting and she's goofing around and acting up a bit. And I guess John Hughes, who made Uncle Buck, who made all those movies in the 80s, apparently, according to, you know, a few reports, not the most fun guy to be around on a movie set. And he kind of ripped her for doing something and literally said, you know, stop horsing around. You're screwing up the set. We're losing time. And you got to get these lines out, kid. And that Candy stepped in and approached her and said, listen, can we go over some lines? Because I need some help. If you could run these lines with me, I just can't seem to get the hang of it. That was the memory she told me. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, give me a John Candy story.
Well, I have so many of them, but here's one. John was so, he had this big, chubby, lovable face. And when I started working with John on stage, it was really, I noticed right away that when I did a sketch with John, when I came out and we did a two-hander together, the audience instantly loved us because they loved John. So that's part of your work in starting a sketch on stage, is you got to get the audience to like you first. And when they instantly like you, because the guy you're with is just this big, chubby, lovable guy, half your work is done. Now you just have to, what you have to do is not screw it up.
Right.
So anyway, John and I, this is where Second City sort of became street theater. John and I decided to do this sketch one night where we would just do gibberish. And try to make it make sense, but not have any actual English words in the sketch. So we started doing this, and some drunk woman in the theater threw a highball glass at us, and it literally smashed at like shoulder length against the back wall between John and I. And I had to duck out of the way to keep from getting glass in my eye. And I just left the stage immediately. And we had these parkas that the Toronto cops would wear and the caps with the red bands. And I just grabbed those, one of those on my way out. And John's still on the stage. And I get into the house and I go, who threw that glass? And the audience become children. They all suddenly become point at this woman. And I just said, you out. And so she gets up and starts walking towards me, but she's got to make her way through the tables. And now I'm thinking, what the hell? What am I going to do when she gets here? I'm not a real cop. And John was told me, he said he was on stage and he thought I was a real cop. It was, you know what I mean? The house is kind of dark. And John said that his first thought was he couldn't believe how fast the cops got there. By the time she got to me, John was at my side. And so I didn't know what to do with her. And I said, what do you want to do with her? To John. And John literally takes her by the arm and he walks her back through the bar and he says, and she was drunk. She was drunk out of her mind.
Yeah.
And he told her that she was barred from the theater until she cleaned up her act and that she was going to have to go out through the back door. And he opened the back door to the alley and put her outside and closed the door. So there's that street theater aspect to John.
Yeah.
It's John had edge. John was this guy that would do exactly what you said, you know, take a little girl aside and make her feel good during a sketch. And he was always great with children on the show when we had children on the show too. But he had another side to him too, where, you know, he was a big guy and he was not a pudge ball. He was strong.
Yeah.
We would do bits on stage where we'd play with the physicality because I was a little guy compared to him. I would run at him and literally jump up into the air and kind of tuck myself. And John would catch me like a football and he would barely rock on his heels. It was just, and he had a fantasy world that was consistent on the stage at Second City. So like we called it John's room.
Yeah.
So when you went out and did a room with John, when John walked over there, you knew he was going to the filing cabinet. When he walked over there, you knew he was going to the bookcase. When he reached up there, you knew he was reaching for a blowgun, and he would put a dart in his mouth and shoot you with a blowgun. He reached for a book one night, and this is a mime book, right? It's an imaginary book in this stage reality.
Right.
He reached for a book because I was challenging him a bit. And he said, I got this book for you. And I said, oh, yeah? And he said, here, read the first page. Well, that's easy for an improviser to do. And right. I just before I start, John says, it's in Latin. Wow. The audience just loved that. And do you know what I mean? Because they were part of the gag.
Yeah.
And that was something that he did really well on stage, was he made the audience part of his world. And wow. That's one of the reasons why they loved him so much, you know?
Well, it was a big, wide world, you know? Thinking back when he was running the Argos and everything, my God, he really was Captain Toronto there for a while.
Well, we used to call him Johnny Toronto. That was his nickname.
Yeah.
At Second City, because he was driving around in limos when he had no money. Do you know what I mean? John acted like a star before he was a star.
That's wild.
And so we used to tease him a little bit. Then when he bought the Argos with Bruce McNall and Wayne Gretzky, he flew a bunch of us, me, Dan Aykroyd, and other people into town to see the game in his box, in his private box. Jim Belushi was there. My brother Ian was there. Just Peter, Dan's brother, Dan Aykroyd's brother, and just a bunch of us, of John's friends, that he had put up, and there was this catered thing. And John comes out on the field with Gretzky and McNall. 50,000 people are cheering him, and the dome is opening.
Yeah.
And Dan Aykroyd turns to me, and he starts laughing. He says, he did it.
Yeah.
I said, what? He said, he's Johnny Toronto. He is that guy now.
Yeah.
He actually became the guy that he dreamt of being back at the very beginning when we first started with him, you know?
Amazing. Wow. Fantastic. Back in a minute with Ian Thomas's brother, Dave. What's new for February from our friends at Super Channel? Well, for one, check out the new true crime docuseries called Friends Speak. Now, this has nothing to do with Joey or Monica or Chandler Bing. Each episode of Friends Speak airs as a 90-minute true crime documentary and brings you the unique perspective of the people who were friends with notorious criminals or their victims. Hear firsthand accounts of the days leading up to and the days after some of the world's most notorious crimes, including Casey Anthony, Jody Arias, Chris and Shannon Watts, Natalie Holloway, and the House of Horrors family. New episodes of Friends Speak air weekly as part of Super Channel's Friday Night True Crime Block, or can be viewed anytime on Super Channel On Demand. Remember, Super Channel is available via most cable providers right across the country, as well as streaming live and on demand with Amazon Prime Video channels and Apple TV Plus. Have you been watching season 2 of the Paramount Plus drama Mayor of Kingstown? I just had co-creator Hugh Dillon on as a podcast guest, and Hugh talked about basing the Prison Town series on his own hometown of Kingston, Ontario. Parts of season 1 were even shot at a decommissioned prison in that Canadian city. Now here's some good news if you're a Paramount Plus subscriber. The streaming service has just picked up the rights to a series that helped make Dillon an actor to watch several years ago in Canada, Durham County. The series ran from 2007 to 2010 and also starred a couple of great Canadian actresses, Helen Joy from Murdoch Mysteries and Lawrence LaBeouf from Transplant. Dillon played Detective Mike Sweeney on Durham County. He's on the hunt from a serial killer who he may have a strong connection to way back from his past. Adrian Mitchell, who went on to executive produce CBC's Coroner, was the co-creator of this eerie series, which frankly was years ahead of its time. Check out Durham County, available toward the end of February, and also watch Mayor of Kingston, all streaming in February on Paramount Plus. Here he is again, Dave Thomas. One sketch that you guys did together on SCTV, and I would laugh till I cried, was Lin Yi Tang interviewing Godzilla. You can't do Lin Yi Tang anymore, no. Dave.
Oh, my God. Boy, would they roast me. Yeah.
But, you know, that came out of a tradition of English music hall, and, you know, there's roots to that kind of humor, right? That it's...
Oh, yeah. Tony Randall played Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe.
Right.
Peter Sellers had played Asians and Indians. And, you know, it was still okay in comedy to do that. It wasn't considered racist or white privilege or anything like that.
Yeah. You know? It's amazing.
But I remember John hated that suit.
Oh, the Godzilla suit?
Yes. Here's another funny story that John hated being uncomfortable and hot costumes and things like that. We did this sketch called Vikings and Beekeepers. And I took the blame for this because I pushed this. This is my sketch. And the premise of it was in the year 980, in order to torment the English even more, the Vikings added bees to their raids. So the prop people built us a 40-foot-long Viking ship. And they got all these costumes and furs and everything. But it became a logistical nightmare to shoot this sketch because there was just so many variables, and half the people in the boat were in beekeeper costumes and the other half were Vikings. And John was in a hot fur Viking costume. And the producers, we got behind schedule. And the producer said, we're going to go for it. Meaning if we have to shoot till 5-6 in the morning, we're going to go for it. And John just did not want to do that.
Right.
So John called a friend of his who happened to be the bartender at the Four Seasons in Edmonton and told him to come over to the studio and set up a full bar and that he would pay for it. So the guy did, and he set up a full bar. And then everybody in the cast started drinking.
Wow.
And when the hairdresser threw up in the Viking boat, they wrapped us for the evening. And I remember John just kind of nodding like, see, I told you, we're not going to go all night.
He made an executive decision.
He didn't want to go all night.
That was brilliant. As SCTV went on, you and Rick, Moranis started, you would pop in and out of the show because you had all these other projects. You were doing albums and the movie Strange Brew. Bob and Doug was such a phenomenon. What was that like kind of coming at that period, being in and out a bit of SCTV? Was it hard to step away, or were you glad to step away? You must have been exhausted doing all that other work.
Well, right. You've answered it, really. We're both kind of ambivalent because we love the show and we love doing it. But the 90-minute network show for NBC and CBC was a ball buster. That was so hard to keep coming up with material for that. And it just burned us out. And by the time we left, I don't think I had another idea. Do you know what I mean? I was like spent. And so part of it is relief that we don't have to do that every night. And it wasn't a 5-day week. We were working 7 days a week in order to write the stuff and be able to shoot the stuff and get it in front of the camera. You know, we'd come home after a long day shoot, and we'd still have to write and write stuff before we went to bed. So it was really hard to stay ahead of that. And so when the McKenzie brothers came along, we were still doing the show when we did the album and when we first started doing it. But when we got the offer to do the movie, we thought, yeah, maybe it's time. Maybe we should.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Hard to believe that was 40 years ago, Dave, right?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Right? Incredible. Yeah.
One of the first things I ever did was a part in a movie called Grandpa and Frank. And I had a scene with Henry Fonda.
Wow.
And I remember this is 78. And he was, and I remember looking at him thinking, he was doing this in 1938, 40 years ago. Oh my God. And now here I am.
Yeah. Yeah.
40 years since Strange Brew. Yeah.
It's like Neil Young once said something about his parents kept listening to, Perry Como, always Perry Como on in the house, Perry Como. And then he realized that he'd become Perry Como.
Right. That is true.
It happens. I just want to ask about the new show. This is something I don't know a lot about. You did this after SCTV. Lorne Michaels, created Saturday Night Live, and then there was 5 years there from 80 to 85 that he stepped away. And then they made this show, the new show. And my God, the writers on this series, Dave, Buck Henry and Jack Handley, Al Franken, Valerie Bromfeld, Steve Martin.
George Myers, who became one of the key guys on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
it was Gamble and Prost. They wrote Seinfeld.
But I've never really heard about I don't know much about it. Why is it sort of lost in time, this show?
Because it was a total failure.
Wow. Why?
Partly because, for two reasons. One, because Lorne wasn't really committed to it. He wanted to go back to SNL. And he had left SNL. And I think Dick Ebersole was running it at that point. And he wanted to go back. And so he wasn't really committed to it. And then the other thing was NBC wasn't committed to it either. And they gave us a terrible time slot, Fridays at 10 p.m., which for an hour comedy show is just all the young people that you would want to bring in as your audience are out
right
on Fridays at 10 p.m. So Yeah, I remember going into Lauren's office and saying to him, I was mad at him, really angry, and I brought in the rating sheet, and we were like 68 out of 75 for the week, and I just, he had promised that, you know, he was going to make us all stars, just like he'd made the people in SNL stars, and he had, and I went in and I just said, so what is the celebrated producer of SNL doing about this? Why, how do you explain this? What the hell is going on? Why are you not, he wasn't around much either, you know? Why are you not around? Why are you not doing this? And he looked at me, and this is his greatest skill in diffusing angry talent. He just looked at me and he said, you know, it's true. Instead of thinking about what great sketch I'd like to do, these days when I get up, I think about what I want to eat that day. And I just burst out laughing because I thought, well, that's either disarmingly honest or the best damn response to what, to my little tirade that anyone ever could have come up with, you know? So he was, it was very strange because he wasn't, he was like a very generous guy. He was very good to me, got me an apartment, and you know, I'm a Canadian in New York, you know, and he was, and he was very, he was always very smart in the people he hired, because the cast and the writing people that he put together. But there's always a little extra something that any show needs in order to make it hit, you know, and that was missing on the new show. And
so interesting, yeah,
never went anywhere.
You went on later to do the Dave Thomas Show. I don't know if this was maybe with for CBS, was it, Dave?
Yeah,
and I remember watching this series. I think that's maybe the first time I actually interviewed you, when I was at the TV Guide talking about that show. And there was a sketch on there where you're playing Michael Caine. And this plane goes down, and Caine survives. He lands in the seat from the airplane on the ground, right, I think?
A seat and part of the fuselage.
Yeah.
He's still attached to it and can't get undone.
Yeah.
He's known as the man in 12J.
He's walking around with a seat strapped on him. I laughed and laughed. Pretty elaborate gag. What was it like working on the Dave Thomas Show?
You know, it was a lot of fun, and there was some really good stuff that we did on that show that I'm still proud of today.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had great writers. You know, Ed Solomon, who wrote Men in Black, was a writer on that show. Mike Myers, Marty's brother, Mike Short, and it was a great writing staff, and we came up with funny stuff. And I, you know, Chevy and Marty on the show as guests, Dan Aykroyd as a guest, Catherine O'Hara as a guest, and it was just, it was fun. And the problem is, sketch, just, you couldn't give a sketch show away in prime time. So many people tried it, you know, Ben Stiller, Eddie Murphy, Marty Short. Yeah, yeah. So many people tried it, and the audiences didn't like sketch in prime time anymore. It didn't connect, you know?
Even to this day, Dave, isn't that true? I mean,
I think.
Yeah.
And it's weird, because when you have an axiomatic rule like that, that just invites being broken. There was one when I remember people saying, you cannot, since the Flintstones, you cannot do prime time. You cannot do animation in prime time.
Yeah.
Then The Simpsons.
34 years later.
Not only do you do it, it becomes a mega show, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No kidding.
So there's no such thing as rules in prime time or television, period. But I do think that that was something where a lot of people tried sketch shows in prime time and nobody clicked.
Yeah, you know? It still seems to be the case. You moved on to a sitcom, Grace Under Fire, which was a great success, and with Brett Butler, and you played the pharmacist, right, on that series? Yeah. And one of the other guys on the cast, Tom Poston, who I've always admired, was on the Bob Newhart show, or Newhart, I guess, goes all the way back to Steve Allen's show. Did you get to know him, and what was he like?
Oh, he became like a surrogate dad to me. We became such good friends, you know, and he was so playful. He was such a, like a little kid, you know?
Yeah.
And he was up for anything. He was always up for doing something funny, and he would do anything to get a laugh. And he didn't believe that there should be any rules for comedy. And his wife, he remarried later when she passed away. But before she passed away, she was a board member of this group and of women who were rape victims. And so they asked Tom to be a speaker at this.
Okay.
And Tom gets up and he says, you know, it's a thrill for me to be here tonight. And I have to say that it's such a sad thing that so many of the women here are victims of rape. But as I look across the crowd, I just have to say, well, no wonder. Look at the way you're dressed. And he got booed and literally escorted off the stage. And his wife was like, what the hell is wrong with you? And he goes, what do you expect me to do? I'm a comedian. Why did you even ask me to be on this?
So, well, you know, you got to take a chance, I guess.
Yeah.
Wow. Hilarious. during the time, you told me this story years ago. I just want to revisit it. It's an amazing one. Dave, we're running late here. I hope you have a few more minutes. Great. Johnny Carson, of course, was heroic to many of us, 30 years as host of The Tonight Show. But during your, I believe this, during your run on Grace Under Fire, I think you maybe had an office near his or something on a studio lot, but there was an opportunity for you to go to lunch with Johnny Carson, right?
Here was the connection. There was a guy who wrote on Grace Under Fire named Bob Smith, who had been a writer for Carson. And one day, Carson's nephew, Jeff Soltzfanger, I forget how to pronounce his last name. Anyway, he ran Johnny's company, Carson Enterprises. He was on the lot, he ran into Bob and me, and he started talking. And Johnny phoned him while we were on the lot. He had one of these massive phones that were the cell phones back then.
Right.
And he said, what are you doing? He said, I'm standing here with Bob Smith and Dave Thomas. And Johnny says, well, I'm jealous. You guys are having all the fun. Why don't you come over here and have lunch? So we drove to Venice he was at this restaurant that he was a partner in called Shotzi's. And we had lunch with Carson. Now, I had done his show as a guest that point. So he knew who I was. And, you know, I was so thrilled to be having lunch with Johnny Carson. But we just had the best time. And there was I told Johnny, I said, you know, we didn't just watch your show, me and my friends, Marty Short, Eugene Levien, we studied your show.
Yeah.
Your show was our homework. Your show was the world that we wanted to be in, and your show taught us about comedy. But occasionally we would catch on to things that we knew were inside jokes that you guys had that you weren't sharing with us, the audience. And Johnny was intrigued by this. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, there was a group that you would have on occasionally called Los Indios Tabajares. And Johnny starts laughing. And he says, my God, you guys picked up on that? I said, yeah, because whenever you had them on, everybody would be laughing, but not at the jokes, laughing at the premise of having them on. So John said, here's the story. Johnny says, here's the story behind that. He said, they were always kind of in reserve in case the guy that wrote the book didn't show up. Or say, they were guests that we could have on if somebody canceled or whatever. And so they got bumped so many times, it was just sad. But one time when they were on, one of the guys in Los Indios Tabajares is in the bathroom, and Doc Severinsen went in, and he's at the urinal. The urinal beside him, or as I would call it, a urinal. He was at the urinal beside him, and he happens to glance down, and this guy had like an enormous schlong,
right?
And so that word spreads around behind the scenes, and so when Johnny introduces them, Johnny says, "Okay, tonight we have a really," and he puts his hands out like big act, and. And then he said, after every time they came on, he spread his arms further apart. And it's just a really big, big hand. So Ed and Doc and all the people are laughing their heads off at this. And then Johnny said, come on. He said, Jeff's got a tape of all my intros to them cut together where you can see me spreading my arms
hilarious.
And getting bigger and bigger. So I don't know if that's too risque a show or story to tell about Johnny on your show, but
no, I'm sitting here thinking, how do I promote this?
I don't think you can. I have other. He told me, he said, you know, he was talking about retiring even when we had lunch, and he said he'd gone to a Frank Sinatra show, and he said Frank was singing. And he said his lyrics were on the Jumbotron. He was at, right. You know, Madison Square Garden, someplace that had big Jumbotron.
Yeah.
He said his lyrics were on the Jumbotron, and he still couldn't get them. And, wow. And Johnny was frustrated. And he said, what clue was he looking for to tell him that he should retire?
So, well, you guys must have talked a bit about Bob Hope, I imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because Hope would always sort of just walk onto the show in the mid, and they would play Thanks for the Memories right in the middle of him introducing someone else. And I don't think Carson really was that fond of Bob Hope by the later years, right?
He respected who he was and who he had been. But because Bob stayed in the game way too long and his vision was gone, his hearing was gone, and, you know, it'd be like, you'd ask him a question. You'd go, What's that? What'd you say? What's that? So, you know, I think Carson found that a little frustrating to be working with somebody like that, you know? But, you know, we were talking about the Neil Young story about, he's become Perry Como. Here's a story Paul Schaefer told me. When Britney Spears would come on Letterman, they would do exactly what they did for Bob Hope on The Tonight Show. They would bump any guest so that she would come on because she got such ratings for the show that David would have her on whenever she wanted to come on. So she would drop by. So Paul started playing Thanks for the Memories.
It's funny.
As her intro music.
It's funny.
So she says to him after the first time he does it, she comes to him and she says, what was that music you were playing when I came on? And Paul says, well, you know, Bob Hope used to come on The Tonight Show and Johnny would bump any guests for him. And David Letterman does the same for you. He'll bump any guests. And she just looks at him and she goes, who's Bob Hope?
Oh, geez.
So,
oh my God.
There you go.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well, you know. And speaking of Hope, one of the funniest things I've ever seen, I love Dave Foley's The True Meaning of Christmas specials that aired 20 years ago.
And yeah.
It was a special that only aired once because they never cleared the music. But they managed to have everybody on this show. You got Jason Priestley and Jan Arden, Elvis Stoiko. And you're there, and Joe Flaherty. And Joe and Dave are doing Bing and Bowie, and you're there as Hope. And Dave, the gag where you get up and leave and you're followed by Bob Hope's cue card guy is so funny.
The guy's name was Barney.
Oh, were you in on the writing of this special?
Yeah.
Clearly. Did you do that on SCTV as well with the cue card guy, or was there some other place or your other show? That was so funny.
I made it obvious that I was reading cue cards.
Yeah.
But I didn't do that with the cue card guy. It's funny, you know. Again, my sort of impersonation of Bob Hope evolved and kind of went full circle. And I ended up being on Bob Hope shows with Bob Hope.
Wow.
Hosting one of his specials with Crystal Bernard, because Bob was too old to host it himself. And then being invited to his house. And wow. I was at Hope's house in Toluca Lake.
Wow.
And he had this picture of General Patton pissing in the Rhine, which he was very proud of, because he when he showed it to me, he said, you know, there were three pictures of this, and the Patton family wanted them back, and they got the other two, but I'd never give them this one. And sure enough, it's a picture of General George Armstrong Patton with his twin Colts and his pissing in the Rhine. And he had told Hope, set it up. He told people that he would cut a swath through Hitler's Europe and he would piss in his Rhine. And that's exactly what he did. So,
well,
anyway,
man of his word.
And he had photos on the wall of, and this is outside his bedroom at his house, of him with every president, and photos with, and he said, this is Neil Armstrong. He did my special after he got back from the moon. Which is, who else could say that?
That's funny.
You know what I mean?
Oh, no. Yeah. Just Bob Hope.
Yeah.
Listen, I'll wrap some things up here. I just want to quickly mention the Beachcombers. You did this, around 20 years ago as well. They tried to revive that series, that classic. Was that a show that you were especially fond of, or how did that opportunity come up? Yeah.
I mean, it was really corny, but I loved it, you know? I love The Littlest Hobo, too.
Yeah.
There were shows that were distinctly Canadian that I loved. And then when Jackson Davies called me and asked me if I would consider doing that as a kind of a guest star, I just said, sure, I'm in.
Yeah.
And
Graham Greene was also on it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Pretty cool. Beachcombers was a show that in the last season, and it lasted like 20 years, but Hart Hansen wrote on the last season of it. Then years later, you and Hart get together, and then you're writing episodes of Bones. So you're in the Bones writing room as a writer producer. That's quite a leap for a comedy writer. How did that come about?
Well, comedy had changed, as you know, as somebody who studies this and writes about it. You know, somewhere in the early 2000s, it started to get really politically correct, and comedians were getting booed at colleges and things like that.
Yeah.
Barred.
Yeah.
And so it became kind of I started thinking, well, maybe it'd be easier to just go and do drama. And I was friends with Hart because we met at a Little League baseball game where kids were playing Little League and in Malibu. And so Hart said to me, why don't you come up with six interesting ways that somebody might be killed? And I said, okay. So I came up with it, and he says, I like this one. He said, you think you could write a script about this for Bones? And I said, sure. So I wrote the script. They liked it and produced it. Then they offered me a job, and I'd never been a staff writer on someone else's show. And I said, well, I don't think you can afford me, for one. And secondly, and then Hart just kind of smiled. He said, we're doing pretty good. We think we can. And then I said, well, okay, sure. So I took it was great. I had the greatest time on that show. And I acted on it twice, too, which you're not supposed to do on any procedural show. You're not supposed to play different characters. The same actor isn't supposed to play different characters.
Right.
They let me do it. But, David Boreanaz now I've gone completely blank.
Deschanel. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just the nicest people. And I really enjoyed it. And then after that, I did a turn on The Blacklist. And then I started, there's a couple of things that I wrote a book.
Yeah, sci-fi, which novel.
Yeah. It was
a Many Lives of Jimmy Layton.
Jimmy Layton, yeah. And so I, you know, I thought, well, I'll try it. You know, I got opportunity to write with this guy, Max Allen Collins, who'd written Road to Perdition. So I thought, well, give it a try, you know. By the way,
are we going to see more in that series, Dave?
I don't know. Maybe, yeah. I mean, I have another one that I started writing that I'm just about finished. But it's not in that series. It's a different idea.
Wow.
But, you know, who knows? I don't know.
Well, listen, Dave, there's so many things I got to have to move on. You got deadlines and stuff. We'll talk another time, hopefully, about all the animated voiceover work you've done. My God. But there's three quick questions in terms of wrapping things up. One is,
all right.
What are you watching now?
Slow Horses.
Oh, I'm not
it's
familiar
with that.
It's a
BBC show with Gary Oldman.
Oh, wow.
It's about a group in MI5, they're sort of CIA, that are a bunch of losers that get drawn into a real spy thing. And it's pretty good. I thought it was a good show.
Where do you see that?
I don't know.
Netflix or
Apple or one of those.
One streaming service.
It's a streamer, yeah.
Back when you were a youngster, either in St. Catharines or wherever, did you have a favorite show as a kid? Something that you had to run home from school to see, or you just have great memories of?
Well, I had favorite shows at different times. For a while, Perry Mason was a show that I loved.
Yeah.
I loved The Twilight Zone.
Sure.
Because that was great.
Yes.
And I saw it in its early run and first run.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, I was a Star Trek fan when Star Trek came out.
Yeah. You got to be on a Star Trek series, right?
No.
Oh, did you not? I thought you were. Were you?
No, Andrea did, but I didn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
no, still, Andrea played a Ferengi, but I never got to go. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And finally, what is your all-time favorite TV theme song?
Route 66.
Wow.
Nelson Riddle.
That is a great choice. That is a slick song, boy. It really evocative of that era. It's just smooth jazz, right? It's a great
and
tune.
A great road song.
Yeah,
there are certain songs that you get behind the wheel of a car and you got an open road and you put that Route 66. That little piano trill that he did. That's a great driving song.
It's a fascinating series. Sterling Siliphant and all these guys who wrote on it. This is a series.
What a great writer.
Yeah, amazing writer, early 60s, two guys in a Corvette. You can see it on, again, I don't know if it's Tubi or one of these channels, but it's the idea that they would set up in a different city and do another story. And they did one episode in Toronto, Dave. They actually...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, which Route 66 is nowhere near Toronto. But they end up at the Inn on the Park Hotel, and they take a helicopter over what is going to be the new City Hall. And they fly over Exhibition Stadium, and they see these four young women in the stadium. It's empty, and they fly down, and one of them was played the mom on Arrested Development, very young at the time. Can't think of her name now, but it's kind of a mind-blowing show to see all of the stars and talent who would show up on that series over different.
Well, that was originally Martin Milner and George Maharis.
Right. Yeah.
Those were the stars. And then George quit and Glenn Corbett took over.
Right. Yeah. Maharis is still alive. He's still around, yeah. but it's quite a curious show. Dave, thank you so much for all this great, great stories. It's great to see you again. Continued success.
Great to see you, Bill.
And, Have a wonderful time with Paul Schaefer, the toast of Thunder Bay. And we'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
I love it. Okay, will do.
Well, it didn't surprise me that Thomas picked one of the most iconic pieces of music as his all-time favorite TV theme song. The theme to Route 66, the road trip adventure series ran from 1960 to 1964. Nelson Riddle's Route 66 theme was one of the first TV instrumentals to chart on the Billboard Top 30. As Thomas says, you can't help but crank this symphony in strings and brass up to 11 if you're cruising on any highway. By the way, go to DaveThomas.com and check out the vintage caddies from the 50s that ferry Thomas around Southern California. Pretty cool cars. My thanks again to Dave Thomas for guesting on this episode and for agreeing to talk about anything, including Martin Scorsese's long-awaited SCTV documentary, which I somehow forgot to ask him about. No matter. There's so much more to talk about with Dave, and he said to call back anytime. Thanks, as always, to Ace Podcast producer Phil Hong. Please like, subscribe, review, tell your friends. Just generally help spread the word about these conversations with those who make the television we love. I'm Bill Brio. Thanks for listening.